Hello, folks. This is Sassafras, and this is the Heart of Witchcraft podcast. It is October 8th. It is a lovely day. It has been a little while since we spoke, and, well, life gets in the way, and it never stops, does it? Today, we're going to be talking about grimoires. What is a grimoire, and what is the... Not so much what is the grimoiric tradition, but you hear this word getting thrown around a lot, and you hear applications of this word, and so I just want to fill you in. Or rather, to give you my version of it, of the circumstances. So, what is a grimoire? Well, a grimoire is... This is my take. The word grimoire comes from... It's a French derivation. Ultimately, it goes back to the word grammar, as it was used in Latin. And for the longest time in France, the word grimoire was kind of just used as, or the word grammar was used as just, this is a book that is in Latin, in reference to its roots in that fashion. Eventually, this came to mean, it came to mean kind of like nonsense, like a book of nonsense, and in its own weird way, that kind of took on, and actually you see this as a trend throughout history when talking about magic. There's kind of this skeptical version that kind of works its way in where, oh, you know, those sorcerers doing their babbling, it's meaningless, it means nothing. Well, it's ironic because that is kind of a pun of the word grimoire in French. And so, you know, the words that we use for, you know, a magical book or a historical magical book, ironically, can mean a book of nonsense, kind of. But actually, that works. To people who don't do magic, they would page through these things and just not see the point, not get it. Whereas other people who are into this stuff might see it and find sudden inspiration, perhaps. Well, in any case, a grimoire is a historical book of magic, and it can contain a number of different things in it. It's not necessarily just spells, as you may be familiar by now. Knowing a spell is one thing. Performing a spell is another. The various things that are added to spells and added in the doing of magic, the proper setting, so many different things go into it. So just calling something a book of spells, every time I see something that lists itself as a book of spells, or, you know, oh, this book, you know, for sale at your local Barnes and Noble has Barnes, there we go. do I mean kids? No. At your local Barnes and Noble, you know, a book of 500 spells. Anytime I look at one of those things, I kind of, like, inwardly cringe, because if it has, like, what are we going for? Quality or quantity? What? It makes me wonder, and it's always good to, like, reach over and look at them, but no, typically I would not really interest myself in a book of 501 spells you can do in your home. It just seems like that's kind of part of the commercialization of magic, but anyway. So what is in a grimoire? What will you find in a grimoire? Well, the contents you're going to hear is going to sound like your standard Book of Shadows or what have you. I would say that there is a difference here. I'm going to get into it. But let's talk about what's in it first. There will often be, and there should be, bits of magical theory where they are discussing not necessarily like how a spell is affected and how a spell works, although you may well find that in there as well. It can have all kinds of stuff about magical theory, about what goes into it, and all of that. And so I'm kind of using that as like a catch-all for explanations of various, I guess, metaphysical things. I hate that term. Anyway, you'll find recipes. And when I say recipes, I can mean spells, operations, etc., but also more mundane items like, you know, recipes for making incense, making tinctures, making oils, etc. Often you will find tables of correspondences. These are kind of the links between often sympathies, or kind of used in a sympathetic magic sort of way by finding a connection. For example, you'll often find the planet Venus, well, based on its name at least, you know, Venus as a planet can be tied to Venus as the love goddess, or Aphrodite, or, you know, a love goddess in a variety of different places. And it's possible that one of the reasons for this is that Venus is a very beautiful object in the sky, but we're not going to get into that right now. So Venus is often tied to copper. There's a connection between the planet Venus and copper. You can also find other connections. And some of these are just kind of automatically drawn to your mind, although there is kind of a cultural element that can be drawn there. For example, when you think about love, or Venus, or the goddess of that, you know, you can think of roses or other flowers. Nice, and thus, by having the picture, you know, the image of a rose in your head, you think of the scent. What does it smell like? And so naturally, if you wanted to go that far, if you were, say, just kind of coming up with your own table of correspondences, you could very easily tie the scent of roses to the planet Venus. And so what incense would you burn if you were doing something involving the planet Venus? And astral magic is definitely a thing. There are a number of different sources for where the magic comes from, and astral magic is definitely one of them, one of those, or appeasing to the various astral spirits. Well, anyway, so these correspondence tables may well have days on them, because time, as we all know, is very important, and as a vital element to doing magic. And any of you who wonder exactly what I mean by that, well, you know, when is the most magical time of night or day? When would you do your magic? You know, if you can think about a particular time that you would see as advantageous over another one, then there it is. That provides the evidence for what you would find on one of these tables, and its explanations is, it's not always, we are not always the best barometers for ourselves until we try things out and see where it goes. So it's like, it's not always just trust your gut, but definitely note your gut, definitely take an interest in yourself and what you think about it. But from the perspective of grimoires, they're sometimes very, very exact in regards to time. But, you know, think about, you know, witches dancing at midnight, of course, you know, there you go, there's your time justification. The various planets, metals, herbs, animals, angels, demons, things like that are often on these charts. As I said, angels, demons, and spirits may well come into play in a whole other section. Often in these books, there is a register of spirits, or a large, long list, usually very long list, with a host of names, often giving them ranks. So in the visionary literature, in the mystical literature, in history, things such as the Book of Enoch, there are a number of different things like this, the Book of Revelation to a degree, where the author of the text goes on a fantastic voyage. He goes on a wild ride, usually in a dream, or he'll describe it literally, but we know that this, you know, an archangel is not going to reach down and pick you up and take you into the atmosphere in a way that other people would be able to witness. And if so, then it's definitely going to be on the news. You can bet on that, unless the Men in Black show up, right? But anyway, so they will talk about what they saw in the various layers of the heavens. And maybe I should do an episode on what the medieval understanding was, or whatever, like the previous understandings of the universe and the world and where we were in it, and how that plays out in this literature and how you see it. But in any case, when people talk about when something is seventh heaven, they're talking about this kind of concept, and actually that relates to astrology, because each layer in each planet would have its own spirits, its own angels, if you will, until eventually you reach kind of the fullness or the pleroma. The ultimate aspect of the divine is, you know, kind of beyond all of that. And you can see that being evident in Gnosticism. You can see, I do believe there is an element of that still present in Mormonism, where you kind of have these other layers, these other planets, the spirits of those, and at least from the Gnostic perspective, you know, upon death, you would be trying to traverse these various layers of angelic interference, and the angels are actually the villains, kind of, the archons, the lords of this world, in the Gnostic understanding, in one of the Gnostic understandings, because there wasn't a singular one, just as in the early days there wasn't a singular Christianity, there were many, many, many of them. And I'm kind of digressing there, but in any case, and actually, you know, talking about the medieval mindset and the medieval construction of the world, and all of that gets into Neoplatonism and how Neoplatonism was kind of adopted wholesale by the Catholic Church and was just kind of the default understanding. I really, really am kind of itching to do like a gigantic episode on the influences of Christianity on our society, on witchcraft, and on the historical development and all of that. That's a really, really big topic, which actually kind of springs out of the notion that it seems like people are getting their lore about Lucifer from the Netflix show Lucifer, which is in turn from a DC comic Lucifer, which is a spin-off from Constantine. Comic books, as we all know, are actually the modern font for mythology. Modern mythology is clearly written in comic book form. Later on, we'll call them the scriptures. Some people already do. So, there's a grimoiric tradition. And if you look around, others might call it, you know, the ceremonial magicians. But there is a little bit of a difference there because it's not necessarily always tied into... Ceremonial magicians are kind of... a lot of them are organized into sort of societies, little groups, or more national groups like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, or the OTO, these sort of like magic orders from the turn of into the 20th century, around that time. And actually that kind of ties in with all of this, because Mathers, who was one of the folks who started the Golden Dawn, or you know, was in charge of it early on, he did a number of translations of occult texts that we got access to now, and we're getting greater and greater access as more of these manuscripts are showing up. So, right, so he did a translation of a number of different things. One of them I have in my hand here is his translation of the sacred magic of Abramelin the Mage. And I always used to think it was called Abramelin, and I kind of like Abramelin more, but Abramelin is what I hear most people saying. And so... Right, the grimoire tradition, I mean, this more or less nowadays just kind of corresponds to folks who work with the books, the scrolls, the scraps of paper, literally in some cases, which, and of course there have been texts on magic as long as there have been humans able to write them. And so the ones that have come to the modern day, folks are doing their best to learn that magic and do things within that system and working on that system and making improvements, alterations, etc. And occasionally you see comments made about that, or someone in a forum will talk about this particular text or that system. The most famous of these is probably at the moment, and one of the most important, I mean, for anyone interested in the occult in the West, is the Greek Magical Papyri. Which is often called the PGM, which is just an abbreviation of the Latin version of Greek magical papyri. In any case, the PGM is it's kind of like an Indiana Jones story, only a little less exciting. No Nazis get destroyed by the Ark of the Covenant at the end, and they don't find the Cup of Christ. I love the Indiana Jones movies. I really wish that they would do more like it. I guess the Mummy movie is kind of, you know, the old Mummy movie with Brendan Fraser is kind of in that flair. I've never been able to get into it because I've never liked Brendan Fraser. I never liked the guy, so I don't care if I get his name right or wrong. But no, I know some people who absolutely love that movie. Actually, the chick in that movie, who the actress, I don't remember her name. She's the best character in that movie. I love her. In any case, the Greek Magical Papyri is of tremendous interest. It is a treasure. It was assembled over time, kind of, you know, at some point, I should have written his name down because I didn't really mean to get into the history of this book, but it's been put together as a book from a guy who went around and bought up collections of scraps of paper. In history, the magic is always kind of swept aside and kind of ignored, and seen as uninteresting, when nowadays, well, actually in the West, they're just beginning the sort of academic discipline of Western esotericism. So all of a sudden now this stuff is useful. All of a sudden this is objects and items of study, and they should be. For people who are true believers, hallelujah. For people who do magic, who are people who are practitioners, we understand the value and the utility of these things, and how in a lot of cases you're tracking. There is kind of, again, that connection between magic and religion. And there will always be that influence present. And maybe I'll do an episode on that. It feels like... So this episode, I've had a bunch of false starts in talking about things. I've been really down about kind of the situation in the world right now. I think everyone is having kind of a down period of time. I mean, it's after fall, so it's natural to get a little more introspective around this time. I'm sorry. I will drag myself back to the topic of grimoires. Well, anyway, so the PGM is an amalgam. It's a collection. It is all kinds of spells, and they're not long ones. They're not necessarily overly complicated. There's a bunch of large chunks. There are some large chunks. Like, there's something called the Mithras Liturgy, I believe they call it. It's a long thing, which we don't know if it was actually ever used by the Mithraic cult in Rome at that time, or a little after that time. We don't really know if it was used. There are a lot of these texts, like we find in these various forms in Egypt and elsewhere, where we find these really old texts and we don't really know how important they were. We don't really know how circulated they were. The only way that we have to guess as to how important they were is, well, did we find a lot of copies here, there, and everywhere? In the Dead Sea Scrolls, did we find this, that, and the other thing? And then did we find other versions of this or other scraps and bits of paper of this and that here and there? Textual criticism, the history of texts and the history of copies and versions of all of that are incredibly fascinating to me. It's a whole other thing. I'm sorry, I'm still so wildly distracted. Anyway, the PGM was these various spells which were written sometime throughout Alexandria's long history. And most of the items we think date from 300 to 400 CE. That's our best guess. There are bits that are from like way earlier than that. Maybe bits and pieces here and there. It's hard to tell. The PGM, the items that are in it, and of course, it's one of the things about humans and magic, I swear. All of these texts, and now the PGM is not really a philosophic work. It's an amalgam of spells. And these spells are really neat. They have, back then, and particularly in the city of Alexandria, this cosmopolitan place, the fusion and mixture of cultures from literally all over the Mediterranean, the ancient world, do the trade routes, because there was a good deal of wealth there. All of it is an amalgam. They would not understand what we meant by cultural appropriation or closed traditions in this context. They would have no idea what we're talking about. Instead, you'll find spells where you're calling on Jesus in the same breath that you're summoning up Moses. Like, you're using all of these figures for magic that nowadays we wouldn't really necessarily imagine doing so, although you can probably find modern examples where it's like, oh no, this is a spell to Jesus. This is a spell calling on Moses or something in this Pentecostal church. But in the same breath, you're calling on Tahuti, you're calling on a number of different names that we've kind of connected with this goddess or that goddess. There's an alternate name for Aphrodite, which is like, my brain turns it into Nefertiti, but that's obvious, that's terribly wrong. That's a complete wrong pronunciation. But then again, there are all throughout it all kinds of really weird words that we would have no idea how to pronounce. And this is kind of part of magic. How do you pronounce things? And the way in which you pronounce things and use your voice has a power and is part of the magic, definitely. So pronouncing things correctly is important. But on the other hand, I do kind of feel like it's only as important as your results show. It's possible that there is not a singular pronunciation for words of power here and there and everywhere. I'm always reminded of the fact that when I say athemi, that word is not pronounced that way by a whole lot of people, at least here in the States. A lot of people call it an athame, or I don't think I've ever actually heard a living person call it an athame, but it's possible. But for me, it's an athemi. But that's because I watched a British documentary on this, you know, like 15, 20 years ago, and it stuck. That's how I pronounce it. Anyway, there are a lot of different grimoires, and there's a lot of them that kind of follow certain patterns. There is a transmission. It's been shown lately. Stephen Skinner has written a number of very interesting books. one of which I actually think it's his. It's him. Oh, I think it's techniques in the Greek magical papyri, or magical techniques in it, something like that. I believe that this was actually his dissertation long, long ago. I think the book runs something around like $40. But in any case, it traces the techniques that you find in the PGM up through time to the Byzantine period. So, you know, we kind of go from this 300-400 AD, and then he traces the techniques as they pass through and are transmitted into Byzantium in something like 600 AD, into Greece. And then you kind of get this same sort of magic made into, eventually finding its way into, oh, I don't remember if it's the Greater or the Lesser Key of Solomon. It's been a while since I've read that book. Maybe I'll correct this right now. One second. It's the Greater Key of Solomon, as opposed to the Lesser Key of Solomon, which is also known as the Lamegaton. But in any case, you have this sort of spring of magical techniques arising in Hellenized Egypt, with all the influences that came in before it, kind of coming together there, and then that kind of flows up through to Byzantium, you know, in 600 AD, and then into Rome in the long period, because remember, Byzantium didn't fall until the 1400s. It came after, you know, the Fourth Crusade, the disastrous Fourth Crusade, where you literally had, you know, crusaders from the West, which literally just attacked Constantinople. It's more complicated than that, and there's a lot that goes into that. The Crusades are kind of fascinating in a way, but yeah, so Byzantium falls then, and then later falls to the Seljuk Turks, who ironically call themselves the Rum Seljuk, and of course the word Rum means Rome. You have in Western society kind of all of these sort of outsider groups that eventually come in, conquer the place, and take over, and what do they call themselves? Rome. We're Rome. We're still Rome. Why not? Don't we look great sitting here wearing all these clothes? But anyway, I mean, and actually that's kind of a human quality in history as well, where the conquering, you know, the conquerors come in and they take over, and then they look around and they're like, man, this decor is awesome. And then they kind of slowly get conquered by the culture that they now inhabit. You see that again and again and again. The you know, the whole reason for onion domes, the reason you see those everywhere, is because of kind of the spread of cultural influence, technically of the defeated peoples, and yet the influence is undeniable. I love it. Architecture is really a fascinating aspect of humanity. It's really a shame. Now we live in all of these, you know, poured concrete square boxes that literally if you tore them down tomorrow, no one would even notice, because you're going to put up one that looks exactly like it later on. I really, really wish that we did more fancy architecture, even if it is somewhat impractical. You know, since when have humans ever been practical? Anyway, so the evolution of these techniques kind of creeps up and into the Western esoteric tradition, and indeed I do believe that, you know, modern Wicca, modern witchcraft, these are, you know, descended from these are absolutely, you know, the current blooms on the end of the branch of this tree that is Western esotericism. I think that even if you make something up, you can't escape the influences of these various things. And so I think it's always a good idea to review these things of the past and see if they inspire you. See if they pull you in a certain direction, or if they direct your efforts in what you're trying to do. And so often we reinvent the wheel, and we don't necessarily need to. That's not an insult. There's nothing wrong with reinventing the wheel. If anything, great minds think alike. But I do think that, you know, there really is no substitute for knowledge. There really is no substitute for research. You can only make things up for yourself for so far until you feel burnt out, because it's a lot of effort. But then again, there are other people for whom reading is just not a strength of theirs. They just can't. It's torture. They're forcing themselves to do it. That's not necessarily so bad. You know, there are so many ways to transmit ideas. Sometimes good conversations with people can inspire you in a particular thing, or someone can share their knowledge, just like I'm talking to you about all these old moldy books. the idea is to try and inspire you with that, or to try and share something with you about that, or frankly, in the trying to formulate the words for something or find a way to explain something, you teach yourself. You learn as you're trying to prepare your knowledge to be taught, to be expressed. It's one of the reasons why I think everyone ultimately, once you've been doing this for a while and once you're able to, I do think that teaching is very important. You should try to, at least. It may not be a talent of yours. But of course, you know, it's not for everybody. But then again, witchcraft isn't for everybody. I'm not saying quit if you don't teach people. That's really not what I'm saying. Anyway. In any case, I'm a little bit distracted here, and I'm kind of running out of time. So let's just call this was just kind of an introduction to the idea of grimoires and talking about a few of them. It may be that I will talk about a few of the more influential ones, or I may pick out a number of ones that have neat elements in them. At this point, I think I kind of have a backlog of like 4 or 5 or 6 different episodes to do. And that's fine. I mean, you know, it's not a bad thing for myself to kind of put footnotes on, oh, I need to revisit this topic or that topic. I've already had people asking me, hey, why don't you actually talk about astrology? It more so than just trying to explain what the weird circle birth chart is. But if I did that, though, I'd have to come at it from a different angle, because I don't really want to offer, like, aside from the simple worship ritual, I mean, and that's just to give you a base starting point. I don't want to explain something in detail like that. I would much rather give you something bare bones and see what you do with it, and see if you would share that with me. A few other things to look forward to. I am going to do one on magical ethics and ethics in doing magic. A lot of the times, you know, the idea of money and what relationship that has with witchcraft comes into the picture. I'm going to have an opinion on that. And that will be forthcoming as well. There are all kinds of things to come to. Up next is, Samhain is, you know, here it is, the 9th. Samhain is the next holiday that we'll be celebrating. Looking forward to that. Here we are. It's the third of the harvest festivals. And I know everyone witchy loves Halloween and loves pumpkins. And loves pumpkin spice, right? No. Well, in any case, I hope all of you are well. I know it's been a while since I've recorded anything, and I know that this one was haphazard and all over the damn place, but, you know, sometimes you really have to kind of spur yourself on and force yourself to do something. I record this at lunch, and that's why these are very, very poorly edited. In time, I plan on refining those techniques, taking things home, and then working on them. That will probably be a little while from now as I'm waiting for... As I may have spoken about before, she's not yet 2 years old, my littlest, and I have a 7-year old, and I have a much older one who doesn't really need any governing in any way. But anyway, so, you know, tending to the children and doing the household things kind of prevents me from sitting at my computer trying to get the sound right on this. But in any case, time goes on, and it's always useful to share things. I hope all of you are well, and blessed be. This has been Sassafras here at the Heart of Witchcraft podcast, and please be safe.